Turn to John chapter 18. Last week we started talking about the trials of Jesus. And if I was making an outline of this, I would say there are seven trials. The first trial, it was in Gethsemane. And then there were three Jewish trials and three Roman trials. So does anybody remember the first of the Jewish trials? Yeah, it was more of a hearing, but a trial before Annas, the Jewish high priest, though he was not legally recognized by the Roman rulers as high priest of Israel. Second trial was before who? Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, ultimately together there. That was a middle of the night trial. And then there was a third trial. Yeah, exactly. First thing in the morning, also before the Sanhedrin and Caiaphas. And this was the legal trial there. So just a quick reminder of some of the illegalities, because the trial, the Jewish trials of Jesus were illegal on a number of levels. But several of the illegalities there were no trials were to occur before the morning sacrifice. So it could not happen in the early hours of the morning. All trials were to be public and secret trials were forbidden. And so the trial before the Sanhedrin in the middle of the night, when it was very obviously intended to be kept away from public notice, was illegal. All Sanhedrin trials were to be held in the Hall of Judgment in the temple area. It seems as if at least the beginnings of this trial took place within just private residences and essentially back rooms hidden away. The assumption of innocence until proven guilty was a hallmark of Jewish law. And of course, they did not assume Jesus was innocent. They presumed he was guilty and then conspired together to give a veneer of legal conviction there. An accused person could not testify against himself. If you remember, Jesus was ultimately condemned based on his own words. Seventh, there were to be at least two or three witnesses, and their testimony had to be in perfect agreement. So how many witnesses were they able to find that gave an agreeing testimony, that gave the same testimony? Yeah, none, zero. They had several lying witnesses, but even the liars could not get their stories to agree. And then the accused should not be mocked, beaten, or mistreated, which Jesus was all of those three things. In the Sanhedrin trial, the middle of the night trial, he was mocked, he was beaten. It seems as if he might have even been beaten by members of the Sanhedrin as well as by their servants. And so after the pronouncement of guilty, the Sanhedrin, and particularly Caiaphas, and under his authority, led Jesus to Pontius Pilate in the residence and really court of Pontius Pilate called the Praetorium. And they led him to Pontius Pilate to be tried by Pilate. Now, why did they do that? Why did the Jews take Jesus from their court, pronounce him guilty, deserving of death, but then go to Pilate to have him tried before Pilate? Yeah, exactly. Legally, under the Roman law, they could not enforce capital crimes. They had no authority to execute criminals. It was reserved to the Roman government. And so for them to legally execute Jesus, they have to have Pontius Pilate, who would have been the authority in that region, and he absolutely had authority under Rome to execute criminals, so they had to have Pontius Pilate's signing off on it. So verse 28 of John 18, we kind of ended here last week. It says, "And they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the Praetorium, and it was early in the morning, but they themselves did not go into the Praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover." And just a quick reminder, they believed that if they went into a Gentile's house, they would be unclean. And so they wanted to be able to eat the Passover, not be ceremonially unclean. So they stayed outside and had Pilate come to them. So verse 29, Pilate then went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" Summarize their answer to him. Exactly. If he wasn't a bad guy, he wouldn't be here. So the fact that he's in court means he's guilty. And Pilate's having none of this. He says to them, verse 31, "You take him and judge him according to your law." If you want to be that way, fine. Take him back, you judge him according to your own law, and do whatever you want with him, but I'm not having a part of it. So then they replied, verse 31 still, "The Jews said to him, 'It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled which he spoke, signifying by what death he should die.' And so then we have a series of examinations. So that there's several times in the course of this, Pilate goes in, questions Jesus, goes back out, talks to the priest, goes back in, questions Jesus, goes back out, talks to the priest, goes back in, questions Jesus. Some of you may know this already, but Pilate really is in a politically difficult situation. The Jewish people of that era were troublemakers, and they had wreaked havoc, really, in the region with the governors over Jerusalem and Judea, and so much so that Pilate really has to cooperate with them. He has to stay on their good side to some extent, or they legitimately could threaten his job, threaten his position in the Roman Empire. And so the Jews have no legal standing with Rome, but they cause enough trouble and make enough complaints that they could actually bring Caesar into the situation, which is going to end badly for Pilate, because Caesar was not interested in getting involved in the dealings of the provinces. And if he has to start messing around with whatever's happening in Judea, then Pilate's obviously not doing his job right. And so Pilate has a lot of political power at stake here, which is one reason why he's so cooperative with these chief priests. Even though he really is the conquering power, he's still very compliant and working with them. And so verse 33, Pilate entered the praetorium again, called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" So obviously, in the course of the back and forth, which we actually do see in the other Gospels, the Jews had told Pilate, well, he claims to be the king of the Jews. And that charge is calculated to get Pilate's attention. Why would that get Pilate's attention? Okay, it's anarchy or rebellion. If somebody is rising up saying, "I'm the king of the Jews," then, you know, what the implication is that he's going to try to conquer or overthrow the Roman rule over Israel, which is actually what has happened several times before this. It's going to happen again, ultimately, until Jerusalem is destroyed in 70 AD. It happens a couple more times. And so this is something Pilate cannot afford to ignore. So he goes to Jesus and asks him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered him. It says, "Are you speaking for yourself about this? Or did others tell you concerning me?" And so Jesus now says, why are you asking, essentially? Why are you saying this? Pilate's answer said, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" So now Pilate's still trying to figure out what's going on. At this point in time, I think Pilate is acting as reasonably and honorably as he can in this situation, given all of his Roman connections and everything. You know, we'll give him a little bit of leeway for his injustices that he's certainly going to perpetrate. But starting off, he really is legitimately trying to figure out what's going on. He's asking good questions, and he's asking the right questions. And so Jesus says, when Pilate says, "What have you done?" Jesus' answer to him is, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." So Jesus is making some incredibly important statements to Pilate. And as we think about the ministry of Christ, the purpose of Christ's first coming, this verse is crucial. And he tells him, what's the first sentence there in verse 36? What's the first sentence that Jesus says? What does that mean? My kingdom is not of this world. Yeah, he's not there to compete with the Roman rule. It is not from the earth. Its origin is in heaven. And it is a different sort of kingdom than that which Pilate is thinking about. It's not a physical empire that's going to establish a government over various nations. And then he says, if my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight. So he's giving him reasons. Here's how you know it's not of this world. Because if I was a king of this world and was seeking to establish right now an earthly kingdom, then those who follow me would fight. My servants would fight to deliver me from your hands and would fight to conquer Pilate's kingdom and Caesar's kingdom. So he says it again, now my kingdom is not from here. Again, it is not from earth. Part of what Jesus is saying that is so significant is the kingdom that he is establishing is not established based upon earthly powers. It's not established based upon earthly means. It's not developed based upon the way that everybody else has ever established a kingdom. Because kingdoms really are established by conquest. We come in and in some way overthrow and begin to rule over another people or a people. And ultimately, at the back of government is the threat of violence. I mean, even today, and I don't mean this as a negative thing necessarily, but even today, the thing that rules America, even with all of our liberties, is the threat of violence. If we disobey the law, there will be consequences. And so that even if it's a trivial consequence, like getting a speeding ticket and I have to pay a fine, if I refuse to pay that fine, the consequences increase. If I refuse to pay those consequences, they keep increasing until such a point where the government comes in and physically lays hands upon you and physically confines you in a structure for however long that they determine. There is force that is at work. And that's the way the kingdoms of the world work. And what Christ is saying in part in this is his kingdom, the kingdom that he is establishing at that time, is not established by that use of force, by a stronger one coming in and requiring of making someone else comply. It's a different sort of kingdom. Now, if we recognize, we read Revelation, Christ's kingdom will be in this world, and that kingdom he establishes then will be established by force. But that's not identical with the kingdom he's talking about here. He's talking about, if you will, the spiritual kingdom, the beginning to develop this kingdom, and it's not by conquest. And then verse 37, Pilate asks him the question that's pressing on his mind, the question that matters most to him is, are you a king then? How does Jesus answer him? Yes, I am. You say rightly that I am a king. He makes it very clear, especially in John, but in every gospel, he answers his question. He says, yes, I am a king. He does not make any bones about it. He says, for this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. So now he tells us a little bit more about this kingdom. It's not a force-based kingdom. It's a truth-based kingdom. He says, I am a king, and those who know the truth is going to listen to me. They're going to follow my leadership. In this case, they're going to voluntarily follow along and do what I say. So that it is a kingdom of not externally forced submission, but ultimately, as we recognize, it's going to be an internally and voluntary submission to the rule of Christ. And Pilate's response, and I think Pilate is dismissive here. He says, what is truth? I don't think Pilate is wanting to engage in a philosophical discussion about truth and the nature of truth. I think he's dismissing him. I think at this point in time, he's thinking something along the lines of, this guy's lost his marbles, whatever that is in Latin. I don't know, but he's thinking that. And so Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world, and I come bearing witness of the truth. Everyone who's of the truth hears my voice. And Pilate says, what's truth? And he walks out. When he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, what? I find no fault in him. This is crucial. In all of the Gospels, we see this stated in some way. Pilate repeats it several times and recorded in the Gospel of John. But Pilate comes out, and his first verdict is what? Innocent. And they actually did have, in Roman law, something akin to American law double jeopardy. If you're found innocent in a court of law of a crime, you cannot be legally tried for that crime again. You know, once you're acquitted, you're innocent. Even if you come back later and confess to it and describe it in gory detail and said, I did all of this, if you've been acquitted, if you've been found innocent, you can no longer be tried for that crime. And so Pilate has come out and he says he's innocent. And that should have ended the matter, but it didn't. Before we continue with the trial, though, go over to Matthew 27, verse 3. There's an important little interlude here that we need to notice. While this is going on, so while Jesus is being interviewed by Pontius Pilate, Judas is realizing what exactly is happening. We don't know Judas's motivations. We know he wanted money, and the scripture does tell us he's motivated by greed. We don't know what he was hoping to accomplish by betraying Jesus or what he thought was going to happen. But apparently, he did not expect that they would try to kill Jesus. And so, verse 3, when Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. So there's an adjective in that last statement describing blood. Innocent. We have again, this time by his betrayer, that Christ is innocent. There's no reason for him to be arrested, tried, much less condemned to death. The priests say to him, what is that to us? You see to it. Judas says, I was wrong. I betrayed innocent blood. And they just, we don't care. It makes no difference at all to them. And so verse 5, he threw down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. But the chief priest took the silver pieces and said, it is not lawful to put them into the treasury because they are the price of blood. And they consulted together and brought with them the potter's field to bury strangers in. Therefore that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the value of him who was priced, whom they of the children of Israel priced, and gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me. Now, there's a lot going on there. But one of the things that Matthew does here is he says this is a fulfillment of prophecy. Remember, this is a major theme in Matthew. He is showing that Jesus is the promised Messiah. He's the one God said would come to Israel to be their Savior. And so he said repeatedly since the very first chapter, this is in fulfillment of prophecy. And this is significant, but we run into a problem in verses 9 and 10 in the prophecy by Jeremiah the prophet. Now, anybody have a footnote in your Bible that tells you where that prophecy in Jeremiah comes from? Okay, Jeremiah 32, 6 through 9. Go ahead and turn back there. It says, and Jeremiah said, the word of the Lord came to me saying, behold, Hanamel, the son of Shalom, your uncle, will come to you saying, buy my field which is in Anathoth, for the right of redemption is yours to buy it. Then Hanamel, my uncle's son, came to me in the court of the prison according to the word of the Lord and said to me, please buy my field that is in Anathoth, which is in the country of Benjamin, for the right of inheritance is yours, and the redemption yours, buy it for yourself. Then I knew that this was the word of the Lord. So I bought the field from Hanamel, the son of my uncle, who was in Anathoth, and weighed out to him the money, 17 shekels of silver. So what's the connection between Jeremiah 32, 6 through 9, and the buying of the potter's field with 30 shekels of silver in Matthew 27? There's not. Yeah, there's not a connection. Does anybody else have another Jeremiah passage that's in your footnotes? There's one other Jeremiah passage that sometimes is referenced with this, and it does speak of buying a potter's field, but it's in the same vein as this, which we just read about Jeremiah buying the field. And so it honestly, as I read it, and as I've read people trying to connect the passages together, I see no connection except for shekels of silver and buying a field. But that connection is way too flimsy, in my estimation, to justify saying that is the prophecy that is fulfilled by the priest buying the potter's field. So go to Zechariah chapter 11, verses 12 and 13. Then I said to them, if it is agreeable to you, give me my wages, and if not, refrain. So they weighed out for my wages 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that princely price they set on me. So I took the 30 prices of silver and threw them into the house of the Lord for the potter. So what's the connection between Zechariah 11, 12, 13 and the use of the 30 shekels of silver to buy a potter's field by the priest? Okay, so we have the 30 pieces of silver specifically mentioned, and then you have the use of it to buy a potter's field. There's one other very clear connection. He throws them into the house of the Lord, exactly as Judas did. So we rightly recognize that this prophecy that Matthew is referring to is from Zechariah chapter 11. Is Zechariah the same as the book of Jeremiah? No, they're two different books of the Bible. And so we still have a problem there. And there's two things going on. Part of it is actually that there are pieces of this prophecy, pieces of what Matthew says in Matthew 27, that seems to be borrowed from aspects of the book of Jeremiah, pieces of the book of Jeremiah. One thing's very important as we think about how the New Testament uses the Old Testament. You know, we quote a verse and you say, this is in this verse. And we might use one phrase from the verse, but that's it. And then if we're going to a different verse, often we'll give some clue. and also, or this verse says, so this verse says this, and then this verse says this. So I might say Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death. And it also says in Romans 5:8, but God showed his love to us, and that while we are yet sinners, Christ died for us. And Romans 10:9 says, whoever will call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. And so I would connect the verses by identifying those verses. I wouldn't say necessarily Paul says the wages of sin is death, but God commends his love toward us, and that while we're yet sinners, Christ died for us, and whosoever will call on the name of the Lord shall be saved. And you're familiar enough with the passages, you're recognizing it's three different verses. Somebody that doesn't know anything about the Romans Road or the book of Romans, or maybe has very little exposure to Christianity, is going to hear that as one big quote. And that second thing, that it is taking different pieces from different places, is what we see frequently in the New Testament. And they're not always clearly marked as this piece comes from this book, and this piece comes from this book, and this piece comes from this book. And so I think that's part of what's happening, is Matthew is taking really some obscure pieces from Jeremiah and is connecting them with Zechariah. And then the other thing, and this is really the most important aspect of that, is it appears as if Jeremiah and the minor prophet were in a single scroll together. You know, they did not have Bibles, books like we have. They had scrolls. And you try to write the whole Old Testament in a big, long piece of paper and then roll it up, or actually a big, long piece of leather, really, and roll it up. If you try to get all 39 books of the Old Testament in one scroll, it's going to be big and unwieldy. And so they took them and they broke them up so that you would have various pieces in the Old Testament in various scrolls. And so the scroll that contained the book of Jeremiah apparently also contained the minor prophets. And so if I said the scroll of Jeremiah says, and then I quote Zechariah, we would recognize, okay, I know what he's saying. I know what's going on there. Matthew doesn't say it exactly as precise as we might want him to, or as you would expect me to do today if I was doing something similar, but that seems to be what's going on. I would say that is what's going on, is Matthew is saying, essentially, the scroll of Jeremiah says this. This is fulfilling the prophecy found in Jeremiah's scroll. We would have to fill in the blank. Does that make any sense at all? This honestly is a very challenging place, and there's a lot of different ideas of how to understand this rightly. And so that's my understanding. If you dig into it, you're going to find others who are going to argue more for the Jeremiah passage that we read, and I'm drawing a blank on it, but there's another Jeremiah passage that they bring together with that, and they argue more forcefully for how most of this quote is coming from Jeremiah. I really, again, I don't see that, but there are certainly people out there that argue for it. I would say all of that to say, even though this is challenging, there is reasonable explanation and understanding why Matthew says this fulfills the prophecy of Jeremiah. So go to Luke 23. Because what happens is after Pilate examines Jesus, he goes back out and he tells the crowd, I find no fault in him. And then the priests tell him, in Luke 23, verse 5, he says, they were more fierce, saying, he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place. And at that point in time, Pilate says, aha, I have a loophole. He has found a way out, because his area of governance was Judah, Jerusalem, and the southern portion of what we think of as Israel. Just north of that was the region of Samaria, and north of that was the region of Galilee. Pilate had no authority over Galilee. And because Jesus is from Galilee, and the priests are saying basically the beginning of his crime started in Galilee, Pilate says, aha, I can transfer this to Herod's jurisdiction. He could have legally tried it there, but he's finding a way out. Says, ah, Herod can deal with this. And so verse 6, when Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. Herod actually would have had a palace there in Jerusalem that he frequented, because Jerusalem would have been the central place of authority in that region. It was either go to Jerusalem or go over to Caesarea on the Mediterranean coast. And so his family was from Jerusalem. They still had a palace there, so he was in Jerusalem. And so verse 8, now when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, for he had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. So Herod is happy that Jesus is brought before him. Why? He's treating Jesus like he's a traveling conjurer. Come do magic tricks for me, is really what it is. And it says, verse 9, then he questioned him with many words, but he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. And so Jesus in his trial before Herod is completely silent and really does nothing. He doesn't do any magic tricks. He doesn't entertain Herod in any respect. The chief priest accused Jesus. Jesus makes no answer to him. Herod, all he does, verse 11, Herod with his men of war treated him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate. And so there we know that they beat Jesus. They not just put this robe on him, but they actually mocked him and this claim or the accusation that he was royalty. So Herod, he's wanting to be entertained. Jesus doesn't comply. So Herod just says, okay, fine. And he turns him over to soldiers. They make fun of him however they want to. And then they send Jesus back to Pilate. In verse 12, that very day, Pilate and Herod became friends with each other, for previously they had been at enmity with one another. Then we have verse 13, back at Pilate's praetorium. Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, you have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him. No, neither did Herod, for I sent you back to him. And indeed, nothing deserving of death has been done by him. So three times in that one statement, Pilate says Jesus is innocent. He says, I examined him and I found no fault. I sent him to Herod and Herod found no fault. There was no conviction under Herod. And then he says it again, that Jesus has done nothing deserving of death. Verse 16, it says, I will therefore chastise him and release him, for it was necessary for him to release one to them at the feast. So go to Matthew 27 again. Matthew 27, 15. And what has happened here as he's talking about this releasing is it was a custom, as we probably are very familiar with. It was a custom in Jerusalem that the Roman governors had taken up really as a way to appease the Jewish people somewhat, so that every Passover, he would take one prisoner out of the prison and release him back to Israel. Because they had a lot of famous people who were also troublemakers. And so giving back to them certain ones that maybe they revered. And sometimes he even had imprisoned some of the leaders of Sanhedrin. And so it was kind of a way of placating the Israelites a little bit. And so he takes this process, this tradition, in verse 15 of Matthew 27. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing to the multitude one prisoner whom they wished. And at that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore, when they had gathered together, Pilate said to them, whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus who was called Christ? For he knew that they had handed him over because of envy. Now, we're told in either Mark or Luke, I don't remember which one, but we're told in one of the other Gospels that Barabbas was basically a leader of a gang of cutthroats who had tried to rebel against Roman authority, and in that rebellion had murdered people. We don't know who he murdered, but it doesn't sound like he fought the Roman soldiers and killed Roman soldiers, but that he likely murdered some of his own people, some Israelites, as part of his insurrection. And so this is a violent, dangerous man. And remember, the chief priests ostensibly are trying to condemn Jesus lest there be an uprising by the people following Jesus and Rome come in and squash a rebellion. They're trying to prevent revolt against the Roman Empire. At least that's what the chief priests have said they're doing. And so Pilate gives them a choice. Do you want Jesus, who he knows they have sent to him because they're jealous of Jesus, envious of him, or do you want Barabbas, this known rebel, leader of insurrection against Rome, and murderer of Israelites. Well, how do they respond? Which of the choices do they take? Yeah, we want Barabbas. But before we get there, let me just mention verse 19. While he was sitting on the judgment seat, that is Pilate, his wife sent to him, saying, "Have nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him." So Pilate's wife, we don't know what all she knew about what was going on, but she sends word to Pilate, "This man is just. Have nothing to do. Back away. Get out of the situation. Don't have anything to do with him." As she says, she has suffered in a dream that day because of him. Part of what we see through all of this, again, is the absolute innocence of Christ. I know in the context of the Gospels that these claims of innocence are saying he's done nothing. He's not rebelled against the Roman government. He's done nothing deserving criminal conviction. And we know that you can do nothing that deserves a criminal conviction and still be a sinner. We recognize that just because you've never been convicted of crime does not mean you're perfect. However, in this case, we recognize there's a greater significance to the statements. It is not just Jesus has not done what he's accused of doing. It is that Jesus is truly righteous. He is perfect in all respects. So that his execution was not just illegal, but it had no basis of any sort. Jesus had in himself no reason to die, whether it be at the hands of the Romans or a natural death. He had in himself no reason to die because he had not sinned. And the wages of sin is death. Christ Jesus, as the eternal Son of God, as the perfect Son of David, had no reason to die because he was just in every respect.